Sí. Welcome to the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety, the 13th of November 2014, here at the Legislative Building. Little housekeeping. We have our Sergeant of Arms, Warren Hawkins, and Bob Rossi from the House, and the Senate, Charles Marsalis and Anderson Meadows.
Thank you.
You got my back today?
Yes, sir.
All right, good. I want to welcome everybody this afternoon, and at this point in time in our order of service, are there any remarks from our chairs at this time? Senator Representative Hurley? Okay, if not, at this point in time, I would like for each member just to identify themselves real quick and where they represent. Start off with Senator over here.
Senator Allran. Austin Allran, and I represent Catawba County and Alexander County, and good to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Shirley Randleman. I serve Senate District 30. That is Surrey, Stokes, and Wilkes County.
All right, Senator Dan, you want to introduce yourself?
Warren Daniel, Morganton, North Carolina, District 46, Burke and Cleveland County.
Representative Mike Speciale, District 3, Craven, Pamlico, and Beaufort Counties.
Representative Rena Turner, District 84, North Carolina House, Iredell County.
Alan McNeil, House District 78, Randolph and Moore County.
George Graham, District 12, Lenoir, Green, and Craven Counties.
Charles Graham, District 47, Robinson County.
John Faircloth, District 61, Guilford County.
Pat Hurley, District 70, Randolph County.
Buck Newton, District 11, Wilson, Nash, and Johnston Counties.
Yeah, Stan, how you doing?
Doing good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You didn't drive this morning, did you?
No, sir.
Okay.
I flew in.
Flew in.
Yeah. Stan Bingham, Senate, District 33, Davison, and Montgomery Counties.
Thank you all. Thanks for everyone for being here. We'll go ahead and start with our program today with the State Crime Lab Annual Report. And at this point in time, John Byrd, welcome as the new State Crime Lab Director. And we'll try to wrap all this up if we could, if timeline around 2 o'clock. And so at this point in time, Mr. Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to come and present the State Crime Laboratory Annual Report to this esteemed body. Thank you for that opportunity. The Crime Laboratory works forensic cases that benefit every community within your respective districts and across this great state. As an example, DNA scientists during this fiscal year eliminated 75 individuals previously viewed by investigators as suspects. In a time before DNA technology, it's possible that these individuals could have been wrongly convicted. But due to the hard work of certified scientists working in a dual accredited laboratory, the pursuit of truth through science ensured that justice would prevail. My name is John Byrd. I am the Crime Laboratory Director. I was appointed on June the 2nd, 2014, so I've been in office 5 months. And I'm glad that I am the Crime Lab Director. No one is more concerned than me about the tremendous backlog that we have in our laboratory and the lack of timeliness in getting cases back to our stakeholders and customers. I'm attacking this problem with a four-pronged approach. First of all, as you can see on the slide, I have 20 years of experience in the crime laboratory. I'm also a Brigadier General in the North Carolina National Guard. So like any typical operation, I'm going to approach it like an attack. And we're going to approach this four ways: through our quality, with our hiring and our casework, through efficiency. And you'll hear me talk a little bit later about Lean Six Sigma, robotics and technology, as well as transparency and awareness through our discovery packets, as well as education and collaboration, as you will hear more about later, and again after this presentation when the School of Government comes up and presents about the working group for the Crime Lab. The Crime Lab is not the only player in the criminal justice system. You'll see that we're doing everything within our power to attack this problem, but we still need some help. I'm imploring that all of our stakeholders put some skin in the game. We did not get here overnight, and we're not going to get out of the situation that we're in overnight as well. Just the landscape, we are the 10th most populous state, 9.8 million citizens in this great state. That's the number of scientists I have currently, 124 working scientists. That's one scientist for every 79,000 citizens in this state. Seems a little bit out of bounds, but we'll talk more about that later. We are the 10th largest accredited state crime lab, and I'll speak more about that in just a moment, with 27,000 law enforcement officers, 600 law enforcement agencies, plus 600 plus, of course, our 100 counties and 44 districts. Our laboratory is situated in three areas of the state: the Raleigh Crime Laboratory here in the county of Wake, with the majority of our services. It is a full service laboratory, and I'll speak more about that in a moment. That laboratory covers the 52 counties shaded in orange, as well as DNA and toxicology in the blue counties of the Western Regional Laboratory to your left. The Triad Laboratory services 12 counties outlined in yellow, and the Western Regional Laboratory services the 36 counties in the west. I'll talk a little more about the Western Regional Laboratory and the great work we're getting ready to start out there, we hope, in just a few short months. Forensic analysis conducted in Raleigh, you'll see that there are seven forensic sections identified on the slide, and I'm not going to read each of these to you, but we are a full-service laboratory. We can basically analyze anything for forensic evidence that could be submitted to the laboratory, except for maybe water and air. That was supposed to be funny. In our regional laboratories, it is a limited service lab. Drug chemistry, latent evidence, and toxicology are in our triad laboratories. And then in our Western lab currently, we have drug chemistry, firearms and tool mark, latent evidence, and trace evidence, fire debris only. And then hopefully, not hopefully, in a very short, near, distant future, we will be adding toxicology and DNA. Because of the great work of this committee and the General Assembly, we're going to be able to build a new Western laboratory. I'll talk more about that in a few moments, and we'll also be adding toxicology in our Western lab in just a few short months. So I said we're going to attack this with a four-pronged attack. Well, so the first thing is quality. You'll see that in the second bullet that we are dual ISO IEC 17025 accreditation. That is the highest accreditation that can be awarded to a forensic laboratory in the world. And we're very proud of that. We're very proud of our dual accreditation. You'll see that we are accredited by the American Society of Crime Laboratory, Laboratory Accreditation Board, and international standards, as well as forensic quality services, forensic testing. And we're very proud of that accomplishment. But accreditation is about the laboratory, the quality of the laboratory. That was only the first step in our process to improve the quality and reestablish the outstanding reputation of our laboratory. The second prong is certification. This body established a statute that we would have 100% certification. And as of today, every eligible scientist in our crime lab is certified. That's about individual qualifications. So not only do we have the quality of the laboratory system itself, but we also, Mr. Chairman, have the quality within the individuals, which is just as important. Our Forensic Science Advisory Board, are made up of 16 representatives from around the country, including crime laboratory directors from other states, as well as quality managers, as well as professionals and experts within their forensic field. We've been working with them for about 2 years, and they have contributed immensely to the quality and efficiency of our laboratory. One person in particular who's a member of our board is a Lean Six Sigma black belt, which means he's pretty smart in Lean Six Sigma. He's come out to our laboratory and actually assisted us in conducting several projects, including putting robotics online with our laboratory, as well as establishing quicker methods to get the cases out the door, which is the most important thing for our customer. Transparency and awareness is our second prong. I like to call this one just the education prong. Our Forensic Advantage Lab Information Management System is a system where we release all laboratory casework notes to streamline fulfillment of our discovery requests. Ladies and gentlemen, that is an industry-leading standard. No one else in the country releases all of their case notes and reports, including communications logs, memorandums. Everything is released for discovery. No other laboratory, in fact, my peers out in, across the country, call me and say, "Are you crazy?" And I say, "No, we're full discovery, full transparency. That's the way it should be for the criminal justice system." And so North Carolina is leading the way in that effort. We've also established tours of lab facilities for our judicial and defense stakeholders. That was my predecessor who established that. Many of the members of this committee have been to our laboratory. We invite anyone to come to our laboratory and tour. It is a state-of-the-art facility, and we're very proud of that. And as a part of our accreditation, we established customer feedback through formalized annual surveys, as well as court testimony feedback. I will just mention briefly our 2014 customer survey, a number of comments expressing that improvement is beginning to be observed. And we conducted the customer satisfaction survey last year for the first time under our dual accreditation. And then again this year in August, we submitted the survey again. Had almost 100 responses to come back, which was almost a 25% increase of what we had last year. Many of the comments that were made included inadequate staffing, high turnover of analysts. The turnovers led to the inability for prosecutors and defense attorneys to properly prepare for court, and has certainly been a contributing factor to the above-listed issue of backlog and turnaround time. Those are comments directly from folks who conducted the survey, including prosecutors as well as defense attorneys and our criminal justice partners in the sheriff's and police departments. The laboratory was not directly blamed, but the lack of resources, proper funding was greatly lamented. But I would tell you that despite overall frustration with the lab, a large amount of praise was received and directed towards the hard work and dedication of the laboratory. Analysts were commended for their professional behavior, technical expertise, helpful demeanor, and promptness to respond in generally positive interactions. Efficiency is our next prong. Lean Six Sigma, I've spoken about earlier. This is an industry standard in which you eliminate the waste and streamline some of the unnecessary things that we have to do. For example, reviews. The customer could care less if I have to do a review of the report. On the other hand, it is essential to maintain the quality of our laboratory system that we do 100% peer review in our laboratory. So we've streamlined that process. Cooperation from our Conference of DAs, which I know that Peg Dorn, Executive Director, is here today. We want to thank her and her team. They've been exceptionally helpful to us. We have received almost 100% cooperation from all of the DAs in giving us the feedback that we need. We were actually able to take care of almost a little over 2,700 cases that were no longer needed to be worked. We sent a database out to all the district attorneys. They returned it back to us and said, "Yes, take this case out of your queue." What that allowed us to do is then move other cases up higher in the queue so we can get those worked and get them out the door. Huge success. Robotic technology I've talked about. Another effort that we've talked about is a blood alcohol analysis by hospital. That's another collaborative effort that we're working. Again, the district attorneys have found hospitals that are local that can do the blood alcohol analysis. Now, that's only one-third of our total toxicology cases. But that one-third over a period of time makes a tremendous difference. In fact, we've had hospitals in Randolph as well as Gaston and Lincoln County to participate in this program with tremendous success. But it doesn't come without a cost. Our mandatory overtime, over 7,700 hours just last year to try to keep up. Collaboration, you're going to hear from Professor Jesse Smith from School of Government later, so I'm not going to steal any of her presentation, but just to say that the collaboration was absolutely tremendous. The School of Government was formed, or actually formed a crime lab working group to help us. It was extraordinary in its scope and purpose, and you're going to hear a little later about some very simple recommendations that will significantly increase efficiency for my scientists outside the four walls of our laboratory. And I'm excited to be able to hear that report later today as well. Nonetheless, we face tremendous challenges. And I will tell you that just this month, or last month in October, we lost another scientist to industry. I cannot compete with the salaries. This body has been very, very helpful to us over the last few years, and I want to publicly thank you for that support and assistance, but the challenges remain. 71 scientist separations. I have 124 working scientists in three locations across the lab. 71 scientist separations is 57% of my staff. I would dare challenge any businessman in this room to be able to say they can stay in business by losing 57% of their staff. I would challenge that assertion. Just a snapshot of an example, it takes about 2 years to train a laboratory scientist because it's not just the science that we're teaching. We have to be able to handle the science as well as be able to go in the courtroom and testify about that science, teach about the chain of custody, and all the policies and procedures that are required. It's a tremendous effort. So somewhere around 2 years to train most of our scientists at an investment of $114,000. Multiply that times 36 scientists, that's $4.1 million that we've lost in a scientist. We've pursued options to go to the Office of State Human Resources to see could we establish a working contract where you work for us for 2 years to pay back part of that investment. We've been told that that's not possible at this point. So we have to depend on other ways to try to retain these valuable scientists. On the contrary, this body submitted a House Bill 1093 last year proposing a 10% increase in salary. And just to back up and tell you that the State Crime Lab, DOJ Commission, Department of Justice Commission, a market salary survey in which our scientists were found to be an astonishing 16% below the minimum, medium, and maximum averages of not laboratories across in Europe, but in laboratories right here in this region, Virginia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, and local labs here in North Carolina, we were 16% below. With that said, a 10% salary increase would help us shut the door on the attrition. That 10% was about $900,000 last year. We were unsuccessful in getting it all the way through the appropriations bill. But I have to say, this body has helped us in other areas too. So I'm not looking to give horse in the mouth. I thank you publicly for your support. We could not have gotten to where we are without your support. But we still need help. Our challenge is because of the number of cases coming in. We've had too few forensic personnel, 124, as I've already stated. That 124 does not include the 19 toxicologists that this body graciously gave us. And I acknowledge that today. Those 19 toxicologists are very close to being online. It's been a long process to get them hired and trained. We actually brought in an outside expert so we wouldn't have to take our own scientists off of the bench. to train those scientists. They are in the process of, they're about halfway through their training now. In the spring of 2015, all of those toxicologists should be online producing casework. That's going to be a huge difference in how fast we can turn those toxicology cases around. And I've already spoken about the extensive overtime. But there is good news on the horizon. It's not all bad news. This past year, our submissions were around 28,000. But my scientists, working some of that overtime that you see on the screen, were able to complete 33,000 cases. That's tremendous. They are making improvement. They're working hard. And again, as I've spoken earlier with the Lean Six Sigma efficiencies, we are doing everything that we possibly can to turn those numbers around. Additional help is also coming from this esteemed body. The 10 DNA scientists that will be joining us in 2015, we'll start hiring them in 2015. We're very excited. We're going to move those scientists up to the Western Lab, and we are absolutely ecstatic about getting those scientists on board. Because, as you'll see in a few moments, we'll talk about Melendez-Diaz, the Supreme Court decision that forces all of my scientists to have to go to the courtroom and testify live. No more submitting an affidavit, no any kind of video testimony, although we're exploring that as a pilot now. But currently, my scientists, especially my DNA and toxicology scientists, have to travel from Raleigh all the way to the far western end of the state to testify. So typically, that's a 6 to 7 hour drive to the western end of the state, another day to testify, and then a half to another three-quarter day to come back. That's 3 days by most math, about 3 days that they are away from the laboratory, unable to do casework. So the way to fix that is to put the scientists where the casework needs to be, which is in the western part of the state. And we're going to put toxicologists out there, part of those 19, as well as the 10 DNA analysts. We're going to get those out in the western state. So when they do have to travel to court, they're not traveling for 3 days. So help is coming. Forensic biology, just another snapshot. Just an example of why we need those DNA analysts in the western part of the state. When you receive, when 80% of your cases take 3.5 days to work, you can do the math and figure out, well, that's to do all of that work, working 40-hour days, and that means not allowing for holidays, vacation, lunch, potty breaks, or court testimonies. That's just straight 40 hours. Comes up to be almost 50 scientists. I have 24 currently working DNA. But with the 10 that we're going to get in 2015, that'll give us up to 34. And then the efficiencies that we've already created with our robotics and Lean Six Sigma, we believe we can handle the load of casework that's coming into this laboratory. And we'll talk a little more about that later. I spoke just a moment about Melendez-Diaz and the impact that it had on us. In the very first year, toxicologists increased their testimony time by 600% just in the first 6 months. In June of 2009, the Melendez decision came out. It immediately increased how much time our scientists had to spend in court. For 2013-2014, it was 2,835 hours that were spent in court. That's 70 40-hour weeks. That's more than a year. No wonder we can't get caught up. No wonder we're behind when we're spending all of our time on the road testifying. So, again, we're trying to attack this in different ways. The Institute, the School of Government, is going to present in a few minutes, talk about some of the things they're going to do to help us, collaborating with us to assist us in creating efficiencies outside the laboratory. One of the things that this body approved last year was the pilot project for video testimony. We are working, in fact, that working group in our laboratory has already met several times. They've already traveled to a courtroom up in the west, in the Piedmont area of the state, looking at a courtroom there. We think we have a model that we can test out. We have a DA and a defense attorney who has agreed to do a test case to see if we can get it through the appellate court. And in an effort to figure out how can we work through the Melendez-Diaz restrictions and create some efficiency for our analysts to testify. I just want to kind of close some things down. This chart is the visual that really stimulated the creation of the School of Government work group. They came through, a group of judges came through our laboratory as part of our education and transparency. They came through and looked at our lab, and this chart is hanging up in my biology section. The red bars indicate time in travel to court and in waiting to get on the stand to testify. The blue part of the bar represents actual testimony. When you do the math, only 9.7% of that total time, which was 2,835 hours, is actually spent in testimony. The rest of the time is waiting or traveling. And so the way we attack that, again, is we put toxicologists and DNA analysts up in the western part of the state, and working with the School of Government, we create some efficiencies where in the courtroom we can do things better. We can do things smarter by putting analysts on the stand, get them on and get them off the stand in a timely manner. Talked a little bit about this, and I'll close it up because I want to get to some questions time, Chairman. But the Western Lab Toxicology is a little closer now. We're expecting completion of our renovation. We're actually taking our current laboratory, renovating space to create room for toxicologists. That renovation is currently ongoing. They should be done at the end of this year, calendar year, with the anticipation of putting toxicology operations online in early 2015. We're excited about that. Of course, we're depending on others to get that renovation complete. We still have to install the instrumentation and get it verified, but that will not take as long as the actual renovation, and that will give us those 10 toxicologists in the western part of the state. Part of those 19 that this body gave us, we'll get them online and working cases and getting the cases out the door in a timely manner. And finally, the Western Lab. Thank you. Chairman Bowles, without the help of this committee, that $15.4 million to allocate for our laboratory in the West, we would still be in the same boat that we were 3 years ago. But because of that allocation, that appropriation, we're going to be able to build a new laboratory facility at the Justice Academy in Western North Carolina in Edenville with 36,000 square feet. We'll be able to serve the 36 counties up there with everything previously mentioned, as well as biology and toxicology services. And just to finish up, that's just a picture where Edenville is located at the Larry T. Justice Western Justice Academy. Chairman Bowles and ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for the opportunity, and I will open it up for questions.
Thank you. And in all due respect, now, can we address you as general?
When I'm wearing my civilian clothes, Chairman, it's probably better just to call me either John or Director.
Well, you get more respect than as a general.
Yes, sir. I understand. Yes, sir.
Any questions? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You spoke a lot about training.
Yes, sir.
And I was trying to determine what type of training. You know, I'm sure that your officers are certified when they leave college and they come with a basic degree, but what other type of training are you engaging?
Thank you, Representative Graham, for that question. You mentioned certified in your question. They do not come to us certified. They come to us with a Bachelor of Science, generally in chemistry or biology or physical science, maybe in computer science. When they come to us, they have to be trained in our methods and procedures under the ISO quality standards. That's an established training program. When they actually do that program, they go through the program and then they work sample cases, practice cases, if you will. They're not real cases at that point to make sure they have the techniques and procedures down. They're tested, they're evaluated, they go through a mock court proceeding where they're trained how to act in the courtroom and what the proper proceedings are for there. It's a process that goes on so that when they walk out the door, they are fully prepared to walk into the courtroom, swear an oath to tell the truth, and establish through that testimony everything they did to a case forensically and testify about those findings.
One follow-up.
Yes.
Is there a pass or fail?
There is always pass or fail, and we have scientists who cannot pass the program. We have had scientists in the past who did not pass the program and are no longer with the laboratory.
Thank you, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions, if I might. Director Byrd, is there any situation in which you would not accept something brought to you in the lab? Do you have any kind of acceptance of materials to be analyzed and so forth, any guidelines for that?
Representative Faircloth, yes, sir. We have what's called case management guidelines that reflect guidelines found around the country. In fact, prior to September of 2013, our guidelines were, if you want to submit it, you can submit it. Anything and everything, and we did. We accepted everything in our vault. At that point in time, in September, in consultation with our Forensic Science Advisory Board, who looked at us and said, what in the world are you doing? And said, you really need to establish some limitations. So what we did is, rather than saying we're not going to take certain things, we said we're going to prioritize what an agency can submit. So what we told agencies in certain cases, submit the first 10 items. We'll work those 10 items, get you that report back, and then if you need additional analysis, absolutely submit it, and we'll continue working that case until you're satisfied that you have everything you need to prosecute that case or to defend that case if it's the defense attorney, because we accept cases on both sides. Does that answer your question, Representative Faircloth?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Follow up, if I might. Can you give me a little information on what type of field testing goes on out there with the law enforcement officers if they're finding controlled substances? I know back in the old days we had all kinds of little gimmicks we used to test various drugs, but what exists out there now for the officer to know what he's know what he's probably dealing with?
Representative Faircloth, I am not knowledgeable in what the current testing in the field, what they have. I will find out for you and get that answer back to you through our legislative liaison, but I don't have a good answer for that, but I will find out. What we do see, as the investigators investigate a crime, they collect that evidence up, package it, they submit it to us. In some of the larger agencies, they have their own crime laboratories where they'll go ahead and process the evidence. Or some of the evidence, and then they'll submit other items of evidence to us. But I owe you an answer on that, sir.
Thank you.
And you'll get back with him?
Yes, sir.
Okay. In essence of time, Senator Buck Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Byrd, you, in your presentation, mentioned something about outside training. As part of your efficiencies and to keep the personnel on the job, and that sounds very, very good to me. Can you, I'll ask a couple of questions on that. How much, where's the money coming from to pay for that? I've heard something about lap salaries. Is that correct?
Yep. Yes, sir, it is. Chairman Newton, we have a certain amount of money. We said in the laboratory, we can't get the scientists trained because the ones we are using to train them, our senior scientists, have to be away for court because of Melendez-Diaz. So the training keeps backing up and keeps getting extended out. So we reached out using some lap salary money to pay for those experts to come in and train.
Follow up. Can you give us any sense of how much so far you've spent in lap salaries on that?
I have my chief fiscal officer from DOJ, Nels Roseland. I believe he can answer that question if you allow him.
Please.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Newton.
I need you to state your name and Social Security number, date of birth, address,
my name
photo
is
ID.
Nels.
I'm Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Justice. And
don't hold the mic. When a green light comes on, just leave it. Okay.
We have used lapsed salaries, and we utilize the personal services contract to bring in these experts to provide training. And my recollection is approximately $125,000 to $150,000 contract. But it's a team of 2 to 4 experts. They're spending about 6 months doing the training.
One last follow-up. I'll direct it to you, sir, if I could. Is that kind of figure, do you anticipate that's what would be needed for outside training purposes on an annualized basis, or how would you quantify that?
There's always a need to train with the high turnover. The lab has incurred train new scientists. There are recurring training costs, not just with this one specific field, that we've used lab salaries for multiple training needs for several years. We don't have recurring funding for training for the crime lab in our budget today.
I'll make that one last follow-up again. That's what I was trying to get at. I'm trying to get a sense of what, you know, how much on an annual basis for training, if it was being done by outside, you know, independent trainers. You know, what ballpark are you talking about?
With respect to independent trainers, and also there's training provided by national professional associations, forensic science associations, we use lapsed salaries, kind of a temporary funding source. It averages about $150,000 to $200,000 a year, but we've, with the lapsed salaries, is the historical way we've financed that, sir.
Thank you.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Byrd, you said your backlog is better, and I'm very happy to hear that. Can our DAs now go online and find out where their cases are and where they stand in that case now?
Yes, ma'am. Representative Hurley, you're exactly right. Our forensic advantage system, all of our district attorneys, as well as all of our law enforcement customers, have access to our laboratory information system through the internet, through the web. They can log in, and by putting in a case number or a name, they can quickly search and pull up the status of the case, and it'll identify for them whether it's been assigned, whether it's in process, whether it's complete, everything that they need to know for that case. Yes, ma'am.
In that case, I know y'all sent out papers to bring it up to date and see what was still outstanding and what was still there. But so now you won't be sending those out anymore because now you know where they stand, or?
Actually, it's a twofold process. So the district attorney and or the law enforcement officers, they can search for a case to see the status, so they can determine whether, if it's getting ready to go to court or they have established a court date, they're trying to see the status of the case. They can then look to find it. The other half of that is we formed a database with administrative office reports. They have a database that has cases listed as to whether they've been dispositioned or not. And we combine that with our LIMS system. Our information technology staff at DOJ wrote a program to search that database with AOC. We then generate a list of cases that appear in AOC as suspended. We then send that, we do it as a fail-safe, really, to send it back to AOC or to the district attorneys to determine whether it's confirmed or whether it's going to be continued. We just want to get that confirmation from them before we do anything with the case, before we send it out.
Okay. It does take time to do that, so I just wanted to be sure that hopefully that would be upgraded and maybe be easier for all of you. Thank you.
It has worked fabulously. Our biggest challenge, our DAs are very busy. They're very, very busy, and so getting a response back from them, sometimes it's a little bit of a delay getting a response, but when we get that response back, just the 44 DAs that responded to us, we were able to dispose of 2,700 cases. Actually, they had already disposed them, but we could pull them out of the queue so then we could move other cases in front and get them worked. It's been very helpful.
Thank you. At this time, we had two representatives that walked in. I'd like for them to identify themselves, starting with Representative Burr. And I think, Representative Daughtry, do you have a question? Okay. Representative Burr.
Justin Burr. I represent 67th House District, Montgomery and Stanley Counties.
I'm Leo Daughtry, and I represent part of Johnston County, 26th House District.
And you don't have a question?
I do not have a question.
When I saw your hand, I'm like an auctioneer. When you twitch, I
was waving at you.
Okay. Thank you. At this time, Senator Bingham, and then Representative McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, do I need to give you my Social Security and credit card number?
Just need a photo ID.
Thank you, sir. I've got a couple questions, if I might. The first one, the video testimony, I realize to me, it's such a common sense approach and a significant improvement. But what are the chances of, in your prediction, of this happening where we can, in fact, use this testimony, video testimony, in the future? Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. And thank you for the questions, Senator Bingham. I learned as a general, there's no tactical certainty in hope. But I will tell you, there is hope that this is going to go through the appellate court system and be supported. I will tell you that my feedback from legal counsel, both inside DOJ and outside DOJ, is that it has promise. I can't give you a percentage on how successful we think it will be, but we know that in other states it has been accepted and is being used.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask one other question? Thank you, sir.
You got the floor.
All right, thank you. At one time, I know, and this has been touched on by Representative Faircloth, about law enforcement really not realizing what to turn into the lab and the Senate excess in numbers. And I know there had been some discussion about through the schooling process of allowing the DA conference, et cetera, maybe to educate sheriffs and law enforcement keys. Is that in-house, or is that moving along, or where does that stand, or has that been totally dropped?
No, sir. We are doing the education. We have an active education program, both with our DAs and defense attorneys. We have partnered with the North Carolina Justice Academy when they put their classes together. We have input from the crime lab on our evidence submission guidelines. That's part of their basic law enforcement training, as well as some of the classwork at the Justice Academy. And also, I've talked to our law enforcement partners every day on the phone. They are always calling about questions. Well, can we do this? Just in fact, anecdotally, sir, yesterday we're partnering with, and I can't remember the county, but we have a sheriff's department that's reached out to us and said, hey, can we get a class together for our crime scene investigators? And I said, absolutely yes. I've already assigned two of my senior scientists who are also law enforcement trainers. They will go down and give them instruction on collection, preservation, and submission of evidence. Yes, sir, that is ongoing.
Thank you, General.
Thank you, sir.
Representative McNeil, and then we have State Crime Lab Working Group coming up.
All right. Thank you, Director Byrd, for your presentation so far. I had a question about the Western Laboratory and $15.4 million. And is this a turnkey budget? And I mean by that, does it include all the startup costs? Does it include equipment needed to basically start operation? And also, as part of that, do you feel like this budget, and I know what you're probably going to say, but is this going to be a final budget? Do you think you can hold it to this? Do you see an anticipated cost that may cause this to go higher?
The actual building itself, this is turnkey. The equipment, some of the scientific equipment, we held off in asking for some of the operational cost of the building for utilities. That will be coming out in the new budget year. Submit the request for that because we incur a cost for maintenance and utilities on that new building. The equipment, we had put in a request last year for some of the equipment that would be offset by DNA grant money. We know now that that DNA grant money is going to have to be used for other purposes, for supplies, and because that that actual grant is decreasing. So there is going to be a minimal expense to buy the initial equipment 2 years from now, because the building's not going to be, it'll take us somewhere, and forgive me, but we don't know how long exactly how it'll take. The architects say 18 months, but it could be 24 months, depending on weather. And
if you're going through DRA, it'll likely be 3 years.
We hope it won't be that long, but we've been very careful not to ask for money for the equipment until we need it. And so we probably won't see, and I'm going to defer back to Mr. Roseland, but I think, if I recall reading the budget correctly, that we're not asking for the equipment money until the 16-17 year, and we're asking for the maintenance and fees, I think, also at the same time. But I'll defer to our chief fiscal officer, who has the exact figures and what we're asking for.
Quickly, and state your name again, please.
Nels Roseland, CFO for the Department of Justice. Director Byrd is correct. We are asking for the next two-year budget cycle in the second year of the biennium about $1.1 million for new DNA equipment. When hiring the 10 new scientists, without the equipment, their jobs would be impossible to do. But we do expect the crime lab optimally to be online in the next 2 years, but that is due to the construction cycle and good weather in Western North Carolina and other factors that may not be in our control. But our contract has a term, construction term of 2 years set up in it, sir.
Any follow-up, Neil?
Yes, I do, and I'm just throwing this out here for a suggestion. I know when the Triad lab was brought online, all of the 12 counties, I think, that was involved in that, that service those areas, were asked to use forfeiture funds to help buy the equipment. And I just wondered if there had been any consideration of that, because I know each county had some skin in the game when it came to that as far as helping buy the equipment. Has there been any thoughts about doing that again?
Representative McNeil, yes, sir, there has. And there's already been some discussions on that point. My predecessor and I, Judge Joe John, and I went out to the West, met with many of the agencies out there and had that very discussion out there with them. But no commitment from their end at this point, because again, I think until they see some block on the ground, they may be a little hesitant.
Thank you. Representative Graham from Robinson. I think you have, and it's, then we need to get to the UNC School of Government. Go ahead,
thank,
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Byrd, I have a question. And then I've heard the issue or concerns with the turnover. I understand, you know, folks leaving for better employment, and I understand retirement, but I don't understand 27 people who the state has trained and invested well over $100,000 to train for these positions, and since 2010,
yes.
And there's no, I don't see a particular reason why that's happening. Is there, can you talk a little bit about that? Is that a miscellaneous reasons? Why would someone leave for just miscellaneous reasons? I'd like to know why that's happening.
Representative Graham, it's a great question. We include that in the miscellaneous. We do a exit interview with all of our scientists, with every employee who leaves the laboratory. An example of a miscellaneous, we had a young scientist who was married to a professional in another industry. The industry transferred the family member to another state, and so the scientist went with them and was employed in another laboratory in another state. The reverse of that has happened also. We had a scientist leave with her husband, and then 5 years later, she came back, and we just happened to have a position open. We allowed her to interview again. And when she came on board, we cut the training time in half for her because she was already trained. So that's an example of miscellaneous.
Personal reasons. But can you elaborate on that?
when they put personal reasons, they don't really elaborate on why they're leaving. It could be anything from they don't see an opportunity for career progression. It could be that they don't see an opportunity for to do all the things that they want to do. They may have come into the laboratory. I know we had one scientist who came into the laboratory thinking this is what they wanted to do for the rest of their life, and they discovered that the courtroom terrified them. And so they chose the wrong career, and so they were having to go back and start all over again. Does that answer your question, Representative Grant?
Yeah, I'm okay with that answer.
And I'm sure he'll call you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Be glad to.
Has everybody got your contact number?
I believe my legislative liaison is here.
Okay.
Christy Agger can, by all means, provide it to anybody that needs it.
Thank you. And, General, thank you for your presentation. Good luck. And I'm sure we'll be seeing each other again in the near future. And both hands out. All right. Thank you. Thank you for great work. At this time, we have the State Crime Lab Working Group report recommendations with Jessica Smith with the UNC School of Government and Anna Mills Wagner, our senior resident superior court judge, District 19C, which is
Rowan
County. You know this lady?
I do.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
Thank you,
Judge.
All. Thank
floor
you.
Floor is yours.
Thank you. Representative Bowles. As Representative Bowles indicated, my name is Anna Mills Wagner. I'm the senior resident Superior Court judge in Rowan County, District 19C. And Jessica Smith and I from the UNC School of, I still call it, well, it is the School of Government, not Institute of Government, were asked to report today on the work of the North Carolina State Crime Lab Working Group. Our working group consisted of 14 members, district and superior court judges and prosecutors from three of the state's judicial districts, as well as representatives from the North Carolina State Crime Lab, at that time, former director Joe John, legal counsel Joy Strickland, and representatives from the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys and Indigent Defense Services. I served as the working group's chair. Our goal for the working group was to develop administrative procedures to reduce the backlog at the crime lab. The working group was formed in the spring of this year after a group of 20 Superior Court judges, of which I was one, visited the state crime lab in connection with the judicial college course that was being offered by Professor Smith. At the lab, we saw and heard firsthand the impacts of the backlogs at the crime lab. We saw an evidence locker full of untested evidence and a huge big pile of what was supposedly marijuana wrapped up very carefully. We also learned that judges and prosecutors during our visit were inadvertently contributing to the backlog at the lab. After our visit, Professor Smith asked three judges from three judicial districts to participate in a working group along with our chief district court judges and our elected district attorneys. Again, our focus was on administrative solutions that required neither legislative action nor funding. We expressly set aside legal solutions implicating constitutional issues such as a blanket procedure for remote testimony for lab analysts, which has been spoken of already today, and again focused on administrative changes that would have lasting impact, hopefully for our courts and judicial system. We met and worked over the summer. We completed our report in late September, and in October we transmitted our report to all of the senior resident Superior Court judges in this state, the chief district court judges, and the president and the president-elect of the North Carolina Conference of the District Attorneys, as well as to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Mark Martin. That same month, Professor Smith and I presented the working group's recommendations in person to the senior resident Superior Court judges at our annual meeting in October. The working group made 17 recommendations, all of which were agreed to by every member of the working group. Our working group further recommended that individual judicial districts adopt these 17 recommendations by way of a memorandum of agreement to be signed by the senior resident, the chief district court judge, and the electric district attorney in each district. To facilitate implementation of these suggestions, the working group, we included in our final report a sample memorandum of agreement that individuals could adopt wholly or modify as needed to accommodate their local districts and their local practice. Professor Smith, who was a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful help to us on the working group, is now going to provide you all with an overview of our 17 recommendations.
Jessica Smith, I'm a professor at the UNC School of Government. As Judge Wagner indicated, the working group recommended 17 specific recommendations, administrative changes to reduce backlog at the lab. All of those 17 recommendations basically fell into one of three buckets. The first was recommendations designed to improve communication between the district attorney's office and the lab regarding the need for testing and the need for analysts to be in court. The second bucket of recommendations was around procedural changes in the courtroom to facilitate analysts getting in and getting out and back to the lab so they could continue their testing. And the third were just some general administrative changes to help the lab do its work. Falling in that first category of recommendations, those to improve communication between the DA's office and the lab, are, for example, recommendation 12 in the report, which says that when the district attorney's office has requested testing in a case that's been resolved by, for example, a plea, that as soon as it's resolved, or certainly within 5 days of the expiration of the appeal period, that the prosecutor has to notify the lab with a stop work order so that that test can come off the lab's testing docket. What we found when the working group started is the lab reported they weren't getting these stop work orders. And what that meant is they were spending precious time testing material in cases that had been resolved, but nobody had notified them that they'd been resolved. So that's one example of improving communication. Another one is in cases where the district attorney's office has subpoenaed the analyst to appear in court, if the case is resolved, again by plea, or perhaps it's continued, that the DA's office use that forensic advantage system, that electronic information database system, to notify the lab the analyst isn't needed. If it's within 24 hours that the person is supposed to be scheduled to court, they have to go further and send an email or make a phone call. Why? Because the working group learned that sometimes the analyst would be subpoenaed, they'd leave the lab, they'd travel across North Carolina, the rolling hills of the Piedmont, into the mountains of North Carolina, to find that the case had been resolved. The courtroom was shut, they hadn't been notified, and that precious time away from the lab was wasted, and we could fix that with that recommendation. So those are two examples of basic, simple procedural changes in communication that can help efficiency of the lab's work. The second category I mentioned was changes in courtroom procedures to get the analysts in and out and back to the lab as quickly as possible. These were procedures, some of them are for district court, some of them are for superior court. For example, in a district where the district court is going to be, judge is going to be holding court all week, and there may be two DWI cases involving the same analyst, the recommendation is start the case as scheduled, recess it, continue it for later in the week, and have one day when the district court judge then would hear from the one analyst who's needed in both of those cases. So instead of having the analyst come to court twice that week, one visit. Cut the travel time in 50%. And if you noticed when Director Byrd talked about the hours this past year, over 2,800 hours, a fraction of those were testifying time. It's travel and wait time that we were focused on eliminating. Another recommendation designed to do that is recommendation 10, which is really simple. Appoint a specific person who notifies the judge that the analyst is there in court. The judge has the discretion to take witnesses out of order. If the judge is notified, the judge can hear from the parties, consider that, let the analysts come up, testify, and get back on their way. The third category of changes were administrative changes that we sort of stumbled upon in the course of our work and realized that they would facilitate the work of the lab. For example, One of the recommendations, I believe it's number 14, requires that when a party has a proposed testing order, that proposed testing order before it's submitted to the court has to be submitted to the lab, and that party then has to certify to the judge that the lab has been served and that they either have no objection to it, or if they have objections, that they're presented to the court. Why was that needed? We learned from the lab that sometimes judges were inadvertently including provisions in testing orders that were creating problems. For example, requiring DNA profiles to be uploaded to CODIS when that's not allowed under the federal rules. The lab would have to do cleanup then and communication, spend time communicating back with the court. Or maybe there was a concern about consumption of evidence and preservation, and the testing order said to eliminate a step in the testing. But doing that would not be in accordance with scientific protocols. So by having that certification process in place, we address problems up front, don't need to use the lab's time on the back end to solve the problems. Those are just some examples. All 17 of the recommendations are set forth in the report, along with that sample memorandum of agreement that we created. Where are we? Judge Wagner and I presented these recommendations to the senior resident Superior Court judges on October 20th. That's less than a month ago. In a busy election time in which there's a tremendous amount of transition, both with senior resident Superior Court judges, chief district court judges, and a whole bunch of elected district attorneys. But even so, we already, as of yesterday, the judges reported to me that three judicial districts have already adopted the memorandum of agreement, eight judicial districts are very close to doing so, and 10 district court judges have it on their calendar to work on it. I am not a patient person. My husband can testify to that, but I'm pretty happy with those results. As late as yesterday, former Director John gave me a list of what he considers the five priority districts to work on, and those will be the judges that I'll be in touch with in the next few days to get them on board as soon as possible. With that, I'll ask if you have any questions.
Yes, sir. Senator Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Smith, in regard to recommendation 14, I guess I'm wondering about the legal resources that the crime lab has to review every one of these orders. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I know there's got to be hundreds and hundreds of lab requests that are coming from across the state, hundreds and hundreds of orders that are being proposed. Does the lab have, I mean, who is going to review all these? Does the crime lab have its own attorneys, or is the Attorney General's office going to handle it? And how is that going to work?
Y'all will correct me if I'm wrong, but Joy Strickland serves as the lab counsel, and this recommendation actually came from the lab. They wanted it. Because what was happening is when they weren't being served with the material on the front end, they had to do all that back-end cleanup work. It became a lot more difficult because now there was a judge's order in place. So this was actually requested by the lab and discussed and agreed to by the working group. So I'm sure Joy will have some work, but I think she views it as less work than the cleanup after the fact.
Any follow-up for you? Okay. Representative Newton, Senator Newton.
Yes,
Ms. Jessica back here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you share with us the five priority districts?
Yeah, the five priority districts are District 23, District 25A, 27A, 28, 30A and 30B, and so I'll be focusing on those. I believe they all have new district attorneys, so we're in a transition period, so it may be after January that we get something final.
Quick follow-up, and the reason they're priorities, is it because of their new DAs or because of their volume or a combination? Why are they priorities over?
I might ask the lab to respond to that point.
I might have missed that.
I don't hear you.
How about that? There we go. Joe John, former director of the State Crime Lab. Senator Newton, those are all in the western area of the state, and for obvious reasons, that's where the primary issues arise. So, which is not to say that they're more important than any other area, but that's because of the distances involved. That's why we're focusing on those areas. Mr. Chairman, if, while I'm standing, if I might have a moment, I just want to, on behalf of the State Crime Lab, thank Professor Smith, Judge Wagner, and the other judges and district attorneys who worked on this committee. It's a tremendous example of how, instead of finger-pointing and complaining and whining and moaning, we come together with a common goal compromise and work collaboratively, we can really accomplish something. So we're very happy with this.
Thank you. Sounds like using some common sense too. So yes, ma'am. Last word? Drove all the way? Okay. Thank you. You bet. All right. If you're like me, we're going to take a 5-minute break. We are going to start at 2:15. We'll be in recess to 2:15. We will start at 2:15.
Now it's in sync. So
okay.
I just changed it.
Oh, well, then is it this one that's already up?
Nope. It's an animation.
What I'm going to do is bring it up and save it. There's a slideshow, so we'll go ahead and start.
Oh, that allow the clicking through the animations to work?
I think so. It should work for a. So I'll have the splash screen up when you come up.
Okay. Yep.
And maybe just escape out of this.
Okay.
And bring it up, or I could come up and do that too.
I can do it.
I'm happy to do it.
I got to hold it out.
Yeah. That's it.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
About ready to get started? At this point in time, we have the Council of State Governments report on justice reinvestment. And this time, I'll ask our friend, David Geis, Commissioner of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice of DPS, to come forward. Also, at this time, I'd like to have Senator Bryant introduce herself and what district represent. And glad you're here today with us.
Thank you so much. I'm Senator Angela Bryant, representing Senate District 4, parts of Nash and Wilson County, and all of Halifax, Vance, and Warren.
Thank you. Also, in the audience, I'd like to extend the courtesy of the floor to Secretary Frank Perry. He's back there. Frank, thank you for being here today, and thank you for your support for this great staff that you have. Thank you. Representative Geis, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be back with you folks. I always say it's good to be home when I come over here, but it is good to be with you. And I was going to recognize Secretary Perry. I wanted to make sure he understood all these folks sitting up here, or his staff, and we certainly appreciate his leadership that he provides each and every day. Also, I wanted to recognize our COO, Laurie Dollar. Wave at us, Laurie, so staff will be able to see you. We appreciate the excellent job that she's doing. You know, it was about in 2009 when many of us began traveling down this path, this justice reinvestment path, and we traveled down this path together. It's never been about who sponsored the bill or co-sponsored the bill. It's been about the work of the legislative body, the executive branch, on a bipartisan basis, coming together, asking the Council of State Government Justice Center, the Pew Center, and the Department of Justice to come in and take a look at North Carolina data and give us some indication as how we could move forward. Some have asked what was going on at that time, and many of the legislative members on this committee possibly will remember this. It was a difficult time. It was a time that we faced, according to a report that I dug out this afternoon, a report in 2011, fiscal year 2010-2011, we had a shortfall of $2.6 billion budget gap that we had to find and had to make up. You know, it wasn't just a difficult time for North Carolina, it was a difficult time across this country, and we all faced these tremendous challenges. It was at the point in 2009 when we began talking with leaders from the Council of State Government Justice Center and about our judicial system and about improvements possibly that could be made. It was at that time that they came, they spoke to our entire body. Representative from Texas came and spoke to the body in the chamber that day, and I remember thinking, he's pretty impressive. He's got some good ideas, and we need to have the discussion necessary to see if we can't analyze the data in North Carolina. I also remember the time when I was in the committee room and they were sharing data with us, and it was data such as in 2009, 53% of all new admissions to prison that year were from probation revocations. And of that number, 76% were for technical violations, not committing new crimes, not absconding supervision. And I want you to know the bell went off that day, and I've been excited from that day forward ever since. And the great news is today I'm here to tell you that CSG is here to present us with a three-year review, the three-year review of justice reinvestment in North Carolina, a report card. And I will tell you, as I've traveled across this country and I've been given so many opportunities to talk about the North Carolina story, it is a great story. It is an exciting story. And you will see that today, members of the committee, and it's so impressive. I do want to point out to you that in this review, this document that I was reviewing earlier today, it had one paragraph that stood out. It said the initiative is projected to save the state more than $70 million and reduce the need for 3,000 prison beds over the next 5 years. My friends, I'm here standing before you today. We saved the state over this shorter period of time from 2011 to today. We have saved the state $83 million. And we have the beds that are no longer there. Prison beds that have been reduced are 3,542. We have done better than what the projections at that point indicated that we would do. Very pleased with that. I want to take just a second and introduce a couple of folks, and then I'm going to bring the folks up to make the presentation. And then Ann Preseth will come up, the Director of Community Corrections, and talk briefly. And then I want to come back and talk with you just for a minute about something extremely important as we move forward in the future. First of all, I want to recognize and acknowledge the legislative members that were part of that decision back in 2011. It was almost a unanimous vote. I thank you, both senators and House members. The elected officials, the district attorneys, the sheriffs, the county commissioners, the judges, our Supreme Court justice, our victims advocate folks, our programs people across this great country or great state that worked with us, all of our stakeholders, the sheriff, sheriff's association, etc. Thank you, because you were there partnering with us, and we worked a lot of long and hard hours to get the legislation written and then to move it both in the House and the Senate. And then one of the most important groups of folks I want to recognize, because you know some states have passed justice reinvestment and just have not been able to implement it as we have. And that is the men and women that are here today that work in this work day in and day out across this great state, protecting the citizens of our community and working with the offender population, both inside our prisons and in our community. I thank you. And members of this committee, a lot of these folks that are here are from your home district. And I hope that they will come up and speak with you as you have identified yourself and the counties that you represent, that they will come up and speak with you afterwards, because they can tell you about implementation and what's going on the ground doing this great work. Now, to introduce the CSG staff that are with us, and we'll have one of them that'll actually make the presentation. Marshall Clement will make the presentation. He is the director of our state initiatives with CSG. Marshall has become a good friend and someone that, as I travel around the country, he has been at my side most everywhere that I travel and just does an exceptional job, and I'm excited about him making the presentation. Also with him is Megan Grosso, publications editor with the state initiative with CSG, and Megan actually was one of the leaders that came and worked North Carolina and helped put this bill together, and we appreciate her leadership. And then Michael Clark, the Director of Public Affairs, is with us also and has helped us with getting the word out about this great work that's being done here in North Carolina. So Marshall, if you'll come up and share with folks, I think it's going to be good and something you're going to enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Bowles, and thank you, Commissioner Geis, for the introduction. It's good to be back in North Carolina.
If you'll just state your name for the record, please.
Thanks, Chairman. My name is Marshall Clement. I'm Director of State Initiatives with Council of State Governments Justice Center. Megan and I were recalling that I think it was 5 years ago, pretty close to the day, that we were first asked to come out to North Carolina to talk with many of you, and it's very good to be back, especially to report on what, at least from our perspective, looking at states across the country, are just some tremendous accomplishments and things to be very, very proud of. But it is, as Commissioner Geis said, entirely due to the leadership of the legislators around the table to not only enact justice reinvestment in your state, but to continue in supporting it and sustaining its efforts, but also all of you working across the state on the front lines of the system to actually put these new ideas and practices into place, tweak them along the way when things aren't working, but in keeping the key goals of public safety in mind along the way. I'll be very, very brief. The commissioner has asked me to be very brief in talking about some of the findings that we have put together in a report that we released today that we hope you'll take a look at, that hopefully helps tell the story of what you've all done here, both within the state but also across the country, as well as an infographic that kind of boils it all down for those on the internet with short attention spans. We like to do both versions. But just a little bit about the Council of State Governments. We are a nonpartisan membership association. CSG has been around since the 30s as a vehicle for states to share ideas across the country. The Justice Center, which has about 100 staff working on crime policy issues around the country, works on a range of topics. And we're pleased that Justice Reinvestment is one of the key areas. We're able to work very intensively, again, for the last 5 years in North Carolina, with support from both the Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance. This is a program that has enjoyed broad bipartisan support in Congress and increased support in Congress to assist states like North Carolina and many others as they go through this process, as well as the Pew Charitable Trusts. So I'll talk very quickly about where we were with you back in 2009, and then some of the outcomes to date, and then turn it over to Ann Preseith to talk about the impact of these changes on what supervision really looks like in North Carolina. In 2009, as the commissioner said, you were looking at a much different picture. Between 2000 and 2009, your prison population had grown nearly 29%. The Department of Corrections budget was up nearly 68%, and the projections were that would continue. You'd have to build and operate additional prison space, house the growing number of offenders. And the reasons why we saw that prison population climbing were not favorable. It wasn't just because there were more cases coming through the felony courts and more crime. It was also because people that had been sentenced to periods of probation supervision were failing and being revoked, often after many violations, to prison for periods of time that would result in a prison stay of some 9 to 12 months, but then be followed by no supervision afterwards. And we actually saw probationers choosing to be revoked because they knew that afterwards they would not be supervised when they were released. 53% of all admissions to prison were people who had failed on probation. More people were coming to prison not because they committed necessarily a new crime, but because they had failed on community supervision. And oftentimes those were violating conditions of supervision, not necessarily new convictions. We worked, as I said, over the last 5 years, 15 months of data analysis and working with many of you around the table and the stakeholders in the room, trying to understand what the data was telling us about where some opportunities existed to reduce costs and avert growth in your prison population, but at the same time only do so insofar as it increased public safety. The vote was nearly unanimous in the legislature in 2011, and thanks to the leadership of Commissioner Geis and many of those in the room who helped make that support achievable in the legislature. So what's happened to date? Your prison population in 2011 was projected to increase from 41,000 to 43,000 by 2017. Based on the policies in the Justice Reinvestment Act that were enacted, we projected, based on our best estimates, that your prison population would be reduced slightly and level off to about 38,000 by the end of 2017. Instead, you've actually, as the Commissioner noted, you've beaten those projections. You've reduced your population down to 37,665 as of June 30th of this year. That's an incredible drop in your prison population in a mere 3 years. But what's more impressive, I think, is not just that you were able to see your number of people in prison decline, but the ways in which you did it. Other states, like California and others, have been forced to reduce their prison populations through early releases or other mechanisms. The way North Carolina did it is truly unique and something to be proud of. The result of this averting the growth in your population, you're on track to avert nearly $560 million in costs by fiscal year 2017 by not having to build additional capacity that you would have had to do had you not taken the actions you took in 2011. You've closed 10 prisons since then. You've reinvested in supervision and hiring 175 new probation officers, and crime all the while has continued to decline statewide. This positions North Carolina in a unique place nationally. When we look at what's happened across the country in 50 states to their prison populations in the last 3 years, about half the states have seen their prison populations increase, and in those states, many of which we're working with now, like Nebraska, Arkansas, South Dakota, are having to find parts of the budget they can cut in order to fund new prison construction in order to address the growth in their system. Places like Alabama are facing 190% overcapacity. They're fearing a federal intervention and huge costs as a result of that. You're in the other half of states that are actually seeing their prison population decline for one reason or another, and you actually had the fifth largest decline in your prison population over this time period, getting accolades. I'm not sure if these are welcome or not from the New York Times for the kind of outcomes you're achieving. Two reports, we're releasing this report that summarizes the outcomes to date, as well as this infographic. What's unique is that North Carolina reduced its not only its prison population, but also over the same time was able to reduce revocations and recidivism, and actually hold offenders more accountable by putting more people on supervision when they're released from prison. Prior to justice reinvestment, you had over 100,000 people on probation. You're spending about $120 million supervising those individuals. By the time, because of the way the laws were structured, you had to supervise them more or less the same way. They were either a community or intermediate offender that assigned certain amounts of resources, but you weren't using what you are now, which is a risk assessment tool that's actuarial and actually tells you who's more likely to reoffend while they're on supervision, so you can target your resources, both supervision and treatment, on those individuals. Your high-risk offenders, 31% likely to be rearrested, compared with your low-risk offenders, only 9%, right? Your high-risk offenders are three times more likely to reoffend, and now you're actually focusing resources on that population, and that's what the research tells us. It's the first and most important way to actually change offender behavior. We also saw supervision hearings, and we heard from probation officers when we did focus groups across the state that responding to violations and going to revocation hearings were incredibly time-consuming. Oftentimes, judges would put the person back on supervision because of the amount of time they've been held in jail, and 53% of your prison admissions were now for probation revocations. Two key tools that you put in place, and many other states now have followed in your footsteps, a 2 to 3 day jail quick dip or administrative jail sanction, and then a 90-day sanction for condition violations, both on probation and parole. A number of other states, West Virginia, Kansas, and others, have followed in your footsteps and adopted similar provisions. Again, the goals were to reduce the number of violation hearings, to reduce the time spent in court, and to reduce jail time spent awaiting those hearings. Your utilization of those quick dips, those short wake-up periods of time in incarceration in county jail, have increased. We expect to see that help produce better outcomes, not only in terms of reduced crime, but also reduced revocations. Revocations have come down nearly by half from 2011 to 2014. These are huge drops in how you're able to respond to violations, not by reducing accountability, but by changing the cost effectiveness of that response. But you've also changed how you fund treatment. You had the Criminal Justice Partnership Program, which was not meeting the needs of all defenders you had under your supervision. You instead reinvented that program called TEX, focused on high-risk offenders, required more high-quality treatment be funded. We found that 86% of people coming out of prison were not supervised, and yet they had a higher rearrest rate than those you were supervising. And so this is essentially the risk principle applied to your entire population. So as a result of just reinvestment, you didn't just focus on how to avert growth in your prison population, you actually reinvested in putting more people on supervision so that everyone coming out of prison for a felony would have at least 9 to 12 months of supervision to help them adjust to the community, but also to hold them accountable for their behavior, given the investment you'd made in their incarceration. So as a result, the number of people released from prison who are coming out without supervision has declined dramatically, and that will continue as that policy takes effect. I want to talk about just three things that I think are really important to why North Carolina has been successful from our perspective when we look at how the work here has gone forth over the last 3 years compared to other states where we've been working. The first is undoubtedly leadership from the legislature, in terms of continued appropriations, to the commissioner and his staff, who are among the best we've worked with across the country, to the stakeholders who've been committed to actually putting this into place, to staff that have adopted these changes, which are undoubtedly a lot of work on top of an already difficult workload. Second is the comprehensive nature of the Justice Reinvestment Act you enacted. Other states have just tackled one part of the system, parole, if they have parole, or supervision. You did a number of things in the Justice Reinvestment Act, from sentencing to supervision to responses to violations to the habitual felon law, right? You touched nearly every part of the criminal justice system with the bill you enacted. Not every part has worked out, but in total, you've met your goals by taking that comprehensive approach. And third, the intensity and commitment of everyone in the state to implement this with fidelity and basically making it number one job every single day, from the school government's involvement to the trainings that you've done across the state, the tirelessness with which staff have just traveled to make sure that everyone knows what the new policy is and how to make best use of it, and at the same time listened to concerns and adjusted where necessary. Those three critical pieces, leadership, the comprehensive nature of your bill, and the intensity with which you've implemented it, I think are the reason why you have such great outcomes to show for this time. We look forward to talking with other states about what North Carolina has done, and look forward to working and supporting your efforts in the years to come. With that, I'll turn it over to Ann Preside to talk about the impact on community corrections.
Thank you, Matt.
Ann Preside, Director for Community Corrections. It is a pleasure to finally be on the home field and be able to give you all a firsthand update on what we have done in North Carolina. I have talked in other states. I have talked before other groups about the implementation. So it is really a pleasure to finally be here and be able to thank you all for allowing us the opportunity to make your legislation come to life. And that is exactly what these people in this room have done. And I'm excited that you're here to be able to see this and see the work that the legislative committee put forth for us to do. So just briefly, what supervision looked like 5 years ago. We based on how the offender was sentenced in court, whether it was community or intermediate, what conditions were imposed. We didn't have a large amount of tools that we could use as officers. We pretty much reported everything back to the court. We had to wait through the court process, and so we were not able to respond as efficiently and as quickly. Our caseload sizes were extremely high everywhere. We were contact driven, and I cannot say that enough, but when I look at the people in the audience, they know we counted contacts, and it wasn't what you did, but it was how often were you doing it. It had no meaning to it, and that was what the nature was at the particular time. Intensive supervision was the most popular sanction from the court, and that had to do with frequency. Again, not quality, but frequency, thinking that we were making a difference by continuing to pound the person on the head. Delegated authority, we've had that since 1994, but our numbers were not that high. We have really increased our utilization of delegated authority since the passing of justice reinvestment. We had substance abuse resources, but we were not connecting those to the right person. We had the Criminal Justice Partnership Program, which did, it, I think on average, was about 5,000 people annually that it touched during the year. But it wasn't necessarily touching the high-risk offender. It was touching whomever was referred. And then at that time, there was even discussion about considering lowering the education requirement for probation parole officers. So 5 years ago, that's what we looked like. This is what I want to talk about, is what good supervision looks like today, exactly what we have done. Supervision is based on identified risk and needs. So every offender, when they come on supervision, has a risk and needs assessment administered to them during the first 60 days of supervision. Justice reinvestment codified the use of that instrument, which we built in-house. It has been validated and normed for the North Carolina population. So we're very proud of that instrument. With that information, that is what the probation officer begins to determine, how am I going to best supervise or case manage with this particular offender? So they know what is the likelihood of reoffending, what are the criminogenic needs, what are the things that cause them to commit crime. Those are the things that we begin to tackle during supervision. Quality contacts. It is really exciting. When I look at our managers here and the supervisors, I get emails all the time how they talk about how the conversation between the probation officer and the offender has changed. It is now the probation officer listening more to what the offender has to say, the offender taking accountability for their actions and thinking through different processes. It is a much different conversation rather than the probation officer always telling the offender what to do, but not really giving them solutions about how to do it. So that's really exciting. One of the things that changes the conversation is the utilization of carry guides. Carry guides are worksheets that probation officers use that really guide difficult conversations. We have used over 50,000 carry guides since we've been using those over the last 2 years, and we've had an 89% completion rate for completing those tools. That is phenomenal for officers to know that they're doing good business. We utilize a violation matrix that tells us what's the supervision level of the offender, what's the severity of the noncompliance, and then what's a guide for us to respond to that behavior so that we're not going straight to the hardest hit. Initially, we're sort of ratcheting it up and working through the different tools that we have. We have more offender accountability, swift and certain responses to negative behavior. I am very proud to say that the passing of justice reinvestment helped push us into a proactive atmosphere of helping our officers use incentives and consequences. Right now, we have a pilot going on in 12 counties where we have a probation officer and a supervisor. We are documenting for the first time, and we are the only state in the nation that is documenting the use of incentives on their offender population. Everybody else is documenting consequences, responses, but we're the only ones that are showing that there's that true balance of four positives to one negative, which is what the research says. That's what helps people respond most effectively. So we're very proud of that. We're getting ready to expand that pilot statewide beginning in January. So we expect to see more good results from that. The other thing that we're able to do is monitor the time from when the behavior occurs to when the response is implemented. So that is really beneficial because, again, the sooner you respond, the more likely you have the ability to change that behavior in a positive direction. We have access to more resources. This has really been exciting for us. As I said, CJPP served about 5,000 people annually. In the last fiscal year, we had over 8,000 referrals to our TEXT program. We've had 68% of those were referrals made by the probation or parole officer without court involvement. That means that we're able to get people into services quicker without having to go through the labor and court process. The other thing that we know is so good, of those referrals, 90% of them have been high risk to moderate offenders. So we know the right population is getting referred for services. So that is a plus for us as we move through that process. Delegated authority, this was tremendous for us, for the probation officer to have more tools at their availability without having to go through the court process. We can now impose electronic house arrest, curfews with electronic monitoring if necessary, the 2 to 3 day quick dip, and then high risk delegated authority. And I'm going to show you some numbers on those in just a second. One of the things about high risk delegated authority, what that did for us, that enabled the probation officer to be proactive. When we found out that an offender was high risk, we could simply refer them for treatment at that particular time. We didn't have to wait for them to violate. We've not had that ability in the past. This is tremendous, and when I think you see the numbers of what staff are doing, you can see that we are really getting out there, and through training and constant conversation, staff are beginning to utilize the tools. So you can see that in 2011, regular delegated authority, electronic house arrest, the curfew, sort of the control tools is what we were using at that time. Look at it now. In the first 6 months of this fiscal year, or last fiscal year, 772 uses of delegated authority. That's almost triple what it was in 2011. High-risk delegated authority, this is where officers are getting the offender engaged sooner, but no violations have occurred. We've identified a need, we're getting them into services, and I think that is a tremendous number. The 2 to 3 day quick dips, we were slow going on this, but I think we were very thoughtful about how we started that process. We've seen that it has proven to be very, very successful. Our initial data, we had a study done of 360 offenders. What we found out is that of the 360 offenders that had a quick dip imposed, 92% of them had some type of positive exit, compared to the 360 that we looked at that had not had a quick dip, only 54% of them had a positive exit. So when you start to look at that, it clearly shows for North Carolina that's having a positive impact. The other thing we found is that more people absconded when they didn't have a quick dip versus the very low number of those that haven't. The other thing that I'd say about these tools is that all of them are automated, and we are able to measure the outcomes, and we will be able to provide some sort of tangible results to show you in the future, and I'm very excited about that. Just so you understand the landscape, and Marshall already alluded to this, what I've realized in other states across the country, they did bits and pieces of what North Carolina has done in one county or in a smaller area. We have implemented all of these changes in all 100 counties, all 1,778 probation officers, all supervisors have bought into utilizing these tools. And I think that is a tremendous tall order. Other states cannot say the same thing. They've done bits and pieces on a smaller scale, but we're very proud of the work that we've done. One example that I'll give you, all chief probation parole officers, all of our supervisors have been trained in delivering a monthly meeting so that every month all 248 supervisors and 1,778 officers are participating in the exact same meeting. And that meeting is a one-hour structured meeting that reinforces some principle of what we're teaching our staff, whether it's through the justice reinvestment or evidence-based practices. And then the last thing, how did we do it? Training, training, training. I cannot say enough about training. Our field have seen and heard from us more in the last few years, but what it's shown me is that they begin to understand it. They can now talk the same talk. They understand the direction, the purpose, and how we're getting to where we're headed. North Carolina was the first state to receive funding from BJA. With that funding, we brought in national trainers for the judiciary as well as our staff. We supported the School of Government by providing, we purchased over 5,000 copies of this document that was written by Jamie Markham. Every judge, every DA, clerk's offices, jails, probation officers, everybody who has a stake in justice reinvestment got one of these books, and we're currently working on a second edition now. We did laminated cheat sheet cards because that's how people think. They need something quick and steady to get their hands on and keep it going. We dedicated a position to justice reinvestment. We did for evidence-based practices as well, but Commissioner Geis felt so strongly that we sustain what we started. And corrections folks typically are very good at starting projects, but sustaining them is where we fall short. We're not going to fall short on keeping justice reinvestment going. George Pettigrew, who is here today, is our Justice Reinvestment Administrator. He has done a phenomenal job. He's been in over 44 counties in 27 different meetings, and he brings together the local players, the clerks, the jail, the DAs, the judges, the probation, gets them to understand all of the nuts and bolts about how it works, whether it's a form, whether it's an intake process at the jail for us to bring it, that 2 or 3 day quick dip person in and not have to go through the full implement that most people going into the jail have to go through. He has done a tremendous job, and I think really on a smaller level, in a smaller group, helps the local people understand what we're trying to accomplish. So I give a tremendous amount of our success and credit to the job that he does. Everything we do relates back and ties in with justice reinvestment. Every single conversation we have with somebody, every presentation, every group meeting, it's all done as a result of justice reinvestment. Because it's about being smart in what we do with our resources, our dollars, and our offender population. We continue to advance practices. We don't just settle. There's always another way that we can do something better. There are ways that, there are pieces of justice reinvestment that we haven't really gotten as in-depth with that we would like, but we're getting there. But the things that we're doing now are doing well, and we begin to add to that. The CRVs, I'm sure that's something Commissioner Geis will talk about. We are very excited about that. That is the last major piece of justice reinvestment that we have to work toward. And then the other thing that I think is really important, the focus of a lot of our management meetings have shifted from being focusing on personnel issues and how to deal with that difficult employee to talking about operations and justice reinvestment and how do we make things happen for the public, for public safety, for reducing recidivism, and making sure that we're about good operational practices. So I think that what we're finding is that as we learn from the outcomes that we find, we're going to be able to change what's not working, keep things moving, keep it dynamic. I'm very, very proud of the job that we've done, the job that you all have done, that you were able to be here today to see this and see what we're able to report to the legislative committee. So I certainly applaud the efforts of all of the staff that are here. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, at this time, I would simply like to say thank you to the committee. Thank you for allowing us the opportunity to put your legislation in action. And I'd like to turn it over to Commissioner Geis.
Well, let me see if anybody has any questions for me.
Does anybody have? Oh, go ahead, Mr. McNeil.
Actually, this is from Marshall.
Oh, sweet.
We don't go anywhere. I just want to put it on the spot. Near the end of your presentation, you said not every part has worked out. In your opinion, what parts have not worked out?
Thank you, Representative. I wouldn't say, I guess, not worked out so much as have yet to be, as Ann said, yet to be fully realized. So the ways in which the department's planning to respond to CRVs, which I think the commissioner will speak to, the use of the ASR provision, and there have been some changes along the way. The tweaks that have been made by the legislature as things either didn't work out or needed to be amended, and that's, I think, all to be expected along the way. But for the pieces that have been moved forward and have been implemented and fully adopted, the outcomes speak for themselves, I think.
Okay.
Senator Bryant.
I just wanted to know what CRVs and ASRs are.
I want to know what TICS was.
Yeah, okay.
We live in a world of acronyms. It's worse than the military. Mm-hmm. TECS is the Treatment for Effective Community Supervision. It's mm-hmm. what replaced the Criminal Justice Partnership Program. Mm-hmm. ASR is Advanced Supervised Release, where the offender receives two release dates at the time of sentencing if the district attorney and the judge are in agreement with offering an advanced supervised release time period. It's an incentive for the offender mm-hmm. When they go into prison. And then CRV is our confinement in response to violation, which replaces the ability for the courts to fully revoke a technical violator. Mm-hmm. And so they're given the 90-day period in confinement. And we're getting ready to establish two standalone facilities to accommodate that specific population.
And I just had one follow-up question. How are the counties responding to the jail space issues and all of that? What are sort of the pluses and minuses you're experiencing in terms of how the counties have responded?
Thank you, Senator. They've responded exceptionally well. We have a large number of counties as it relates to the misdemeanor confinement program, I think 50 plus, maybe 57, Mr. Caldwell is here, that are receiving counties, and all the counties in the state are sending counties, but it's worked exceptionally well. In fact, there's a quote there, I believe, in the document from Mr. Caldwell, and he's been a great supporter from the Sheriff's Association, and our relationship with all the sheriffs has been very well. I think early on there was questions because naturally there are a number of counties that do not have space, and there were concerns that maybe they would have to take on a new burden, but we were able as part of that legislation to provide a funding source, and we found the Sheriff's Association a willing partner to lead the effort and survey and determine how many beds were available, and a decision was made to make some counties allow counties to participate, volunteer participation, and that's how we've made it work. And we have a lot of beds still available, and that was a decision in the short session to move forward with the remaining misdemeanors, moving them to the misdemeanor confinement program.
Yes, sir. Representative Graham from Robinson.
I have a question about the chart on the tools for probation officers.
Page
23. I guess this would be for Ms. Preside.
Page 23.
The 2 day Marshall. The 2 day and the 3 day quick dip.
Yes, sir.
The probation officer determines whether it's a 2 or 3 day.
Yes, sir.
Dip. How does he determine, what measures does he use to decide a 3 day versus, or 2 day versus 3 day, or is this in statute?
No, sir, it's not in statute. It's decided between the probation officer and the chief probation parole officer. So when the violations occur, the probation officer staffs the violation, the situation, the whole picture of what's going on with that offender, and then they make the determination. Is it a 2 day or is it a 3 day? It might have an impact if the offender is employed. There are lots of things that could play into which number of day quick dip that they select. There's nothing specific that says you have to do a 2 day first and then a 3 day or anything like that. They just have the choice between the two, and they base it on the situation with the offender.
Just to follow up, comment. So basically you're saying it's individualized or it's situational, and a lot of variables are looked at, you know, in making that decision.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just want to follow up, and the quick dips are done in the local jails?
Yes, sir.
Even if, and just refresh my memory, if they're not a receiving jail, we still can do the quick dip in the county?
Yes, sir. And I would say that one of the things that I know that our staff do is they're very aware of what their current jail situation is. See, I'm seeing the heads nod. And if the jail is full, then we respond in some other manner, and so that we're not burdening the sheriffs with the 2 or 3 days. But I will say that our staff have been very thoughtful about who is receiving a quick dip.
And I assure that the quick dips, that's pretty, he's a pretty regular, or they are pretty frequent flyers.
Actually, they're not.
Good.
It's doing exactly what it's intended to do.
After the first quick dip, it gets their attention.
That's exactly right.
Representative Graham?
Just to follow up, you mentioned something there. There are other alternatives. What would that look like if you can't do the 2 or 3 day because of the limited space? What would you do?
We could use house arrest, which is 24/7. Keep them in the house. Don't let them go anywhere for 2 or 3 days, a week. There might be some other opportunity if the jail is full. But house arrest is the first thing that would come to my mind because that's about as close to confinement as you could get.
Just a comment, if I may. Let me just say, I didn't hear you. You didn't say anything. I need some positive feedback. You mentioned earlier about the pilot in the 12 counties where you're using the positive.
Yes, sir. The administrative response.
Mm-hmm. Positive reinforcement.
Yes, sir.
As opposed to negative reinforcement, and you want to expand that to the rest of the state in January. Can you give us some examples of what that positive reinforcement may look like? One or two examples that you've seen that's been successful.
Yes. What we're seeing from our officers, they have a whole assortment of things that our officers in the pilot developed. And if I could, I would actually like for George Pettigrew, our Justice Reinvestment Administrator, to respond to this because he's very intimately familiar.
Thank you, and welcome to the Oversight Committee. If you'd just state your name for the record, please.
George Pettigrew, Justice Reinvestment Administrator of Community Corrections. I'm glad you asked that question, and we're very excited what we're doing with our administrative response. One thing we know from evidence is that changing behavior is not only needs consequences, but when positive behavior exhibits itself, it needs positive reinforcement. So we have the 12 officers and their chiefs, and we have a system on our case plan system in the computer to mark when they're giving them incentives and when they're giving them consequences. And we have a list of different things. I will tell you, our officers came up with several different things. And I'll also say that our staff every day do incentives and positive reinforcement, but we are starting to document it. The first example is, of course, verbal praise when they do something well. That's important. Some other examples, they take them to their supervisor and say they've done a great job on this. We have JDMs that are giving them recognition. We have areas that now are doing MVP of the month. They have an offender that has done what they are supposed to do. They've changed their they've complied with conditions. We have one area where they're doing a ceremony each month and identifying an offender to bring their family in, and they're giving them a certificate for doing good stuff that past month. And that has meant a lot, and that's out of Cumberland County, Fayetteville, North Carolina. So we want to build on that. We want to measure it and make sure that 4-to-1 positive reinforcement principle is working in North Carolina also. So we're going to expand it to every district, which we have 31 districts in North Carolina. We'll have an officer in each district to help us to develop that even more and go statewide in the future.
Sure. Yes,
just make a comment.
Just stay up there.
It sounds like to me you're doing RTI, response to intervention. And I know Miss Angela's going to want to know what that means. Response to intervention, that's why I said that. But I just wanted to commend Commissioner Geis and Ms. Preseith on their innovative thinking and their progressive thinking with regards to our inmates. And you're just to be commended because hearing this kind of response, pardon the pun, is just a great, it gives us great vision moving forward in terms of how to address these inmates and probationers, and you're to be commended. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, sir, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Commissioner, you had mentioned technical violations, something like 70%, 76%, I believe you did say, were technical violations. What would this include?
Thank you, sir. It's a very good question. It would include simple things like failure to make an office visit, test positive for drugs. It could be not reporting as instructed. Just simple things. They're technical in nature to the conditions of probation, but occasionally they mount up. You've got to have a way to get someone's attention quickly, and we've really found being able to have a measured response and being able to correct that behavior, just like correcting the behavior of a child. If you can do it quickly, you can't wait a week or two. Now, some of these folks that have been around a while will tell you that we had to wait months to get someone in the county jail when the judge ordered a weekend in jail because the jails were full. Well, I would say to you that, hey, by the time we finally got them in for that weekend in jail, they had committed about 15 other technical violations, so it didn't work. So we had to change our way.
Ask one. All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this, some of these reporting to, is that a considerable with cost of gasoline and transportation this day and time, is that a quite a problem for some of these folks? And also, do they have an alternative to notify the parole officer that they are having difficulty in getting to or reporting? I'm just curious.
No, sir, it's not a problem. I will tell you that our staff are out in the community. We don't sit just at a desk waiting for somebody to report. So if there's difficulty having a ride in or getting there, we're out in the community. But I will tell you, that's not been a problem, because most folks, what you'll find, they have no problem getting out in the evening and getting about where they want to go. And those that don't have a license, they'll get on the back of a liquor sickle and they'll make it down to the office. So we really don't have that problem.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, for being so blunt.
I always am.
All right, and if, at this time, I would like for you to open the floor to, I think we need the legislative branch give some recognition to the people that have implemented, and I'll let you introduce.
I will say, all the staff that are here today were selected by administration, Karen Buck or George Pettigrew, because we recognize your efforts in working these tools every day. So it gives me great pleasure to ask everybody from Community Corrections to please stand so that this legislative body can see who you are. And the chairman has extended the invitation for any of you, and I know some of y'all out there, so don't be shy, has graciously extended the invitation for any of you that would like to come to the speaker, identify yourself, and talk a little bit about what you've seen happen in the course of your work with the offender population. Rick Neal, you know I'm looking right at you.
I'm Rick Neal. I'm a chief probation officer in Nash County. I'm Miss Bryan. I'll say that I've kind of been this guy all along. I've been with the department for 25 years. So when this justice reinvestment came out, it was like a huge thing for me. I was one of the original trainers for the stuff going out into the field. It's something I've always done. But this quick dip thing, we've been very judicious with our use of it in Nash County. But those offenders that get that one quick dip, like you said, sir, that's it. We have no more problems out of them. I had a young lady that just kept violating her house arrest. I'm calling her, the officer's calling her. Finally, we go pick her up and put her in jail for 48 hours. And in community corrections, we get an email every time somebody violates their house arrest. So my email would blow up. All of a sudden, I haven't seen her name in a month. And it's just because of that one simple tool and being judicious with it and applying the right tool to the right person. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Rick. Deborah Lemke, I know you're out there somewhere. Deborah Lemke is a field specialist in Charlotte, and she's been a part of the administrative response. If you just want to talk just briefly about some of what you've seen.
My name is Deborah Lemke. I'm a field specialist in Mecklenburg County. Up until about 6 months ago, I was supervising 70 high-risk offenders in Mecklenburg County. I'd like to talk about the carry guides. I think that they mentioned earlier the thousands of carry guides that we've been using with our offenders. It's a great counseling tool. It completely changed the dynamic of my interaction with offenders in my office. It went from my lecturing somebody or someone would report, what's your, you know, has your address changed? Is your phone number the same? Come back next month. Whereas now, the office appointments were 40, 45 minutes of really delving into that individual's criminogenic needs. If they were having problems with their family, I had a carry guide for that. I had a counseling tool. We could work through this worksheet together, and it was amazing how it changed my interaction with offenders. And I use those quite a bit.
Thank you. Anybody else?
My name's Darius Deese. I'm the Assistant Judicial District Manager in Mecklenburg County. I would say to you that justice reinvestment has re-energized the probation officer. It's gotten us back to helping individuals instead of counting the contacts. Like Ms. Precise stated earlier, the probation officer is, for the most part, is a morally sound individual. It's a good person, more than likely a family person. This is the individual that the offender will look up to and will look to guide them on making decisions in their daily lives. I think that us, with justice reinvestment, that offender is able to sit down and have a meaningful conversation at length with no time restraints to discuss what's happening with them in their lives, to discuss solutions to their problems. And I think for us, being an old probation officer myself, I think that I'm happy that we have gotten back to doing business this way. And as you can see from all the statistics, it is truly, truly innovative and is truly changing lives. And I'd like to say thank you and look forward to continuing this process. Thank you.
Thank you.
Deshaun Pola, Chief Probation Parole Officer in Guilford County. The most important piece of all of this is the offender. I make it a point to attend every graduation from the TEX program. I can't put into words to hear the people stand up that would have normally not spoken in front of people, not have taken responsibility for what they've done, accept responsibility, and talk about how their life has changed. And I think it is important that if officers get a chance to attend these graduations, you would see that your work has not gone unnoticed. It is important. You're changing lives, changing families, because when we help the offender, we help them, we help their family, we help their children, we help the community. So I'm very proud to be a part of this program, be a part of Justice Reinvestment, be a part of changing our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard some great news today, and those of us who have labored a while in the criminal justice field have been waiting on this. We didn't know exactly what we were waiting for, but we've been waiting on this. And this is some of the best news for the citizens of North Carolina, and particularly two groups that are hard to document, and we don't hear too much about them, but those two groups are our citizens and the family members of wrongdoers. The typical situation we used to see is a mother would be sitting in a courtroom and her son would be in trouble being tried for something. They would hear the process go on. There would be a judge who would make a conviction or find a conviction and then have a sentence, make a sentence. And then they would see their son, she would see her son go through the doors led by a sheriff's deputy or a correctional official and going off into somewhere she didn't know exactly where and didn't know what was going to happen to her son. And too often, because the system didn't do what we had hoped it would do, when our son came back home, within 6 months, she was doing the same thing over again. I think we're going to see a great change. I think those mothers and fathers are going to appreciate this more than we'll ever know. I think also the victims of crime in North Carolina, we don't know how much they're going to benefit from this, but they are going to benefit from the lack of recidivism that's going to come out of this. We're going to see the crime go down, I think, profoundly for those who have done something wrong, have gone through the system now, and are back out in public. And I think that's going to be a benefit for all of us in the state of North Carolina. I have to praise all of these folks here who first of all, trusted in us, led by the commissioner, to get this legislation through, and then have not fought it. They've taken hold of it, and they've made it theirs, and they're now proud of it. And I couldn't be any prouder, and I think I should probably speak for the others. Just thanks a lot. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And for you all that don't know, that's one of the authors of the bill, retired police chief, before they had standards. And he was part of the standards board, correct? So he's been there from the beginning when you were hired, given a gun, and put out on the road. But he's only 35. But that's your biggest advocate right here. Thank you, Reverend. And I would like to say thank you. I know that in the last budget, I know you all have been sharing your cars. You've been sharing the trunks of the car at every day shift. I think you have to empty it. You're sharing desks. You're sharing a lot of things. The caseloads. We are on the right road. I think you'll see further more improvements. But I thank you for your service and thank you for your patience. And you know, it's 25 years, it's hard to change, but I think you're doing a great job and you're embracing it, and I think we're seeing the results of it. And like Reverend Faircloth says, I commend you. All right, Commissioner, Representative, my friend David, you want to finish it out? Thank you.
Last time I was here, we passed the offering plate before I left, and I think one or two wanted to come to the altar, but we won't take that long. I would just like to thank Representative Faircloth for those that that are in the work. Representative Bowles said it just right. He, along with many others, but he especially worked closely with me as we put together the legislation and worked hard in moving the legislation and addressing the issues that needed to be addressed. And he's someone that his leadership's been a great deal to me, someone that I could rely on and still rely on. But I also thank these members of the JPS committee because that legislation had to come through JPS. And then, of course, our legislative staff, Christine and her staff, just did an exceptional job. The bill drafters, the many folks that worked with us on that piece of legislation, getting it where it needed to be. And, you know, we all file bills. I had no idea when I filed House Bill 642 that it would, I guess, move in the direction that it moved and mean what it's meant to the citizens of North Carolina. Senator Randleman was on that committee as a chair, and someone that I joined the House with at the same time. I don't want to miss any names, but Representative Burr was another that we came to the House together, and it was just a great opportunity to work with them. What I want to share with you just a second, and my staff got up and left that I wanted to introduce, and that was the Director of Prisons and Deputy Director, because there's a piece of justice reinvestment that truly impacts our prison system, and we are changing the culture there, and it's taken us a little bit more time because these folks, it's a huge organization, but we are working every day with regards to that. But the CRV piece, the confinement in response to a violation, and basically it's a way to deal with technical violators, is something that's important, and the Director of Prisons and his staff have joined the Community Corrections Director and our staff at my level working to make that a success. But it was the vision that this body had and the governor had in allowing us and providing the $7.5 million to open up those two closed facilities to set up those CRV sites, one in Burke, one in Robeson County, and they're going to be up and operational December 1. You'll be getting invitations, committee members, to those locations because it is a big deal. It is a big deal, and I believe within my soul that us being able to address that population and their needs, again, we've tried a lot of things, say they're out in the community, but some of those things might not have worked, and we use a CRV. The judge orders that 90-day CRV in that felon case. We have a location that they can go to. They can receive the level of treatment that they're going to need 24/7. We've got treatment layered all 7 days, and it's tremendous. And we've got probation staff that will be staffed there. Their office is located there, working with correctional staff, program staff. It is just going to be great. It is going to impact, I believe, recidivism more than anything else that we've done so far. Now, where do we need to go in the future? Naturally, as I talk with others around the country and visit sites, I hear a lot about second chance money. I hear a lot about reentry money. And these are funding sources through the federal government that can come to states to assist us and help us with these issues. Transitional housing, transition back into the community, is something that we have got to do much better with. It's something that we're working on. We would like to get in a place such as the state of Ohio, the state of Pennsylvania, that has built transitioning into their system. That's extremely important for us to be able to provide treatment, training, job training, housing, and other things of that nature to help folks be successful when they are released. So you're going to be hearing more about that, because we know that we need to focus on that piece. In addition to that, you, the legislative branch, provided an opportunity for me to open up some closed facilities if I could find resources for additional CRV needs. We know that we're going to need more CRV locations. Quite simply, just as soon as the courts and the DAs have an opportunity to visit some of our two CRV sites, they're going to see that we have a program in place, and they're going to hear about the success of that program. So that will expand, and we know that we'll need more resources there. We need your help. You've heard me say that before. We in the field, we depend heavily on the legislature and on the governor's leadership to ensure that we have the resources that are necessary to be able to do this good work. My friends, the piece I haven't talked about today, but that is critical for us in North Carolina, is the mental health piece. And it's one that we face open, openly. We know that not only in North Carolina, but across the country, the failure of our mental health system has caused many people to show up at our emergency rooms, in our county jails, and in our prison system now that have mental health issues. We need to be able to develop the type of program that's going to be effective in ensuring that we do the right thing. And many of you heard me say, it's our goal to do the right thing every day. We will be talking with you about the need for resources there, because it will take some resources, because you just can't commingle that population and expect good results. We've got to be able to offer that kind of assistance and help to that group of folks. So my pledge to you is that we're going to continue to work hard. We're going to continue to plow and continue to do good work each and every day. But I'm going to ask you to join us and help us as you hear more about our budget needs and our needs for the department to move forward. This is a huge Department of Public Safety, and we're very proud of it. Not just about corrections, but our law enforcement piece means a great deal to all of us. We work closely together. It's about ensuring that each and every staff person gets home safe every night, but also that we look at our offender population and see if we can do something different, because we believe that we can make that difference. Thank you for allowing us to spend time with you. I know we've taken a lot of time today, but this was just a great day for us and a great report, and it's actually a great day for North Carolina. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. You have any comments, or Mr. Secretary? You have a great staff. Yes. Thank you. At this time, we're going to, if there's no other comments on justice reinvestment, I'd like to go update on SAMRCAN. Would you all like to stay, or? Okay. Commissioner said yes, y'all like to stay. Bill Stovall, Director of Engineering Services, Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice, DPS, if you'd like to give us an update, please. And first of all, before we go any further, maybe our audience would like to know what SAMRCAN is and what we're shooting for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Oversight Committee. Again, my name is Bill Stovall. I'm the Engineering Director for the Department of Public Safety. SAMRCAN was originally a training school established for girls in, I believe, 1918, if I'm not mistaken. And it eventually became a juvenile justice facility that was recently closed. And it is now being repurposed in order to be a training academy or training facility for basic training for adult correction and juvenile justice. This is a dire need in our department. We have a backlog of training. We have new officers on the job who actually have been on the job in some cases several months before they've had an opportunity to get into a basic training class. This legislative body appropriated $10.4 million last session to undertake the first phase of this renovation. We anticipate that this will allow us to have approximately 90 overnight beds initially from this renovation to begin doing the overnight basic 160-hour basic training classes. And eventually, with a future phase, hopefully if that appropriation would come through, we will be able to take the population up down there to at least approximately 300 beds to conduct training at this facility. My task is to give you a status on where the project stands. I reported before this body last month that we were in the initial phases of construction. Our construction plans were under final review at the State Construction Office in the Department of Administration. I'm pleased to report that we received final approval of those plans on August 29th, and we have been released for construction. Simultaneously, we had an asbestos abatement contract underway at the facility. Most of these buildings of an age where they had quite a bit of asbestos material in those. That abatement project is approximately 65% complete right now. Our schedule for this project initially, we had hoped to be able to stand up commuting classes at the facility hopefully by July 1st, 2015, and then have the full renovation for phase, what we can consider phase one, complete by December 31st of 2015 and actually begin the overnight training classes. We have divided this first phase up into two parts. The first phase focuses on those buildings that will allow us to go ahead and stand up the commuting classes and establish an actual training presence on the site. This involves the administration building, the gymnasium, and the academic as well as auditorium buildings. Those buildings have been cleared of asbestos, and we have our MA work crews in there now, demolishing the interiors of those buildings, basically are gutting these buildings. The asbestos contractor is proceeding on additional buildings that will be in the next part two of this work, the Campus Life Building, the Mitchell Building, the housing buildings associated with Fry and Norton and Hope. That asbestos work should be complete in its entirety by December the 13th. The demolition will continue for the balance of this month and most of next month. We have at least 40 inmates on site with the initial crew working. And by January 1, we anticipate that we will have upwards to 100 inmate workers on the site, and we will be actively beginning the reconstruction of the interior of those buildings at that time. The project is on schedule. You will see a whole lot more activity on the job site now that we've been released for construction. I will certainly welcome any of this oversight group if they'd like to come down for a tour sometime. Feel free to do so. I have a construction superintendent on site, Mr. David Edcock, who would be more than happy to show you around. But again, the project schedule as it stands is that we hopefully will have the day classes stood up or the buildings of that by July 1, and we would have the full first phase or the approximately 90 beds ready for the overnight training classes to begin January 1 of 2016.
Thank you. Have any questions, Representative Burr?
I just want to make sure I heard you correctly a while ago that you've been completely cleared by DOA to move forward with the project. You're not waiting on any additional approval from them at this time?
They have approved the part one. As I mentioned, Representative Burr, there's two parts to phase one. Part one focuses on those buildings and infrastructure needed to stand up the day classes. That part is fully approved. Part two will be submitted for final review by late next week, and we anticipate a fairly short turnaround on that as well. We will be actively involved in the reconstruction part by January 1, and I would fully expect to have the balance of those plans in hand by that time.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. And I guess for the phase two, it'll be the same. You'll be going through the same process you went through with phase one. There's no additional regulation, no additional anything holding you up in terms of working with them to get you what you need.
In terms of phase two, you're talking about the expansion to the 300 beds.
Well, I'm talking about the second portion
of what part two of phase one.
Yeah, part two, yeah.
We're not anticipating any issues there. Early on, we had sat down with the state construction office and discussed, if you look at the code specifically, technically sprinklers may have been required to be put in these buildings, but we look at the type of occupancy that it'll be used for now versus what it was originally, and as the code authority, they agreed that there was less risk involved, and they had the authority to waive that part of the code, so that was a big help in both budget-wise and schedule-wise on the project.
Okay, I was claiming I was out there yesterday. It looks great, and there's a lot of activity going on, and I think it's going to be a great asset to the state as well. And I'm glad it's in my district, and I'll stop in every now and then. And I encourage all of you to come out
and see. And I think once it's completed, I think it's an asset that's needed. And as I stated before, our concern is that the project keeps moving on. I hope that you will contact us if there's any issues as far as DOA, as far as getting plans approved. Me personally, I think we should be further down the road, but I'm an impatient man as well. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stovall, do I need to contact you to make you aware of, because I would like to attend. I've been there a couple of times, years in past, and just like to see what changes you've made. Senator, if there's a particular day you'd like to come out to the job site, now you feel free to give me a call and I can make sure that our staff is aware there. If you actually come out to the job site unannounced, we have a construction office set up there, and there's signage that would direct you there. You can just check in there, and the staff, they'd be more than happy to accommodate you and show you around. But if you give us some advance notice, then I can have my project manager there as well and talk about the plans for the facility.
Thank you, sir. I'll give you a call. Thank you. Does anybody else have any questions, concerns from the committee? Chair? Pat, you have anything? Okay, I'll ask you if you want to take the printed material in your folder, if you'll please leave the folder and leave the membership roster in your folder, but please take the other information with you and leave it where you're sitting. And this will conclude the meeting. Thank you all, and thank you all.